paid news fellowship. Details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Tay Marie Astudio, and Libby Rainey. Special thanks to Miriam Barnum, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're tuned into KBOO Portland. The time is 4:59 and 42 seconds, right there on the dot. Coming up next is your Thursday evening news, but first, how about this?
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is DJ Love Jones, producer of the world-famous Confessional and DJ for Necropolis, starting every Sunday, midnight to 3 a.m. I want to personally invite you to come on out to the Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, February 21st, starting at 7 p.m., Contessa de la Luna, host of the world-famous Confessional, will be live on stage reading your secrets and confessions prior to the movie. There'll be prizes, prizes, prizes. Come on out for a fun evening that benefits your community radio station, KBOO. That's Blazing Saddles, Thursday, February 21st, starting at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. See you there.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Police murder. Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, police murder a child in Vancouver.
The wait for citizenship has doubled over time.
And in international news, deadly fire in Bangladesh.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 21st, 2019. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Rachel Hartley. A 16-year-old child of color was shot and killed by Vancouver police this past Tuesday evening. Clayton Joseph was an immigrant from Micronesia who arrived in this country just 6 months ago. Friends and family say he was a great kid who never got into trouble, and they were shocked and appalled by his death. Police claim that they responded to a report of a disturbance involving a male and a female at an apartment complex on Southeast Ellsworth Road just after 11 p.m. on Tuesday. According to a witness, two males at the scene got into an altercation in the parking lot and both were possibly armed. Police later claimed that the boy had a knife. A family friend said that he was trying to break up a fight when police arrived on the scene and was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Joseph was a student at Evergreen High School.
The tragedy of missing and murdered Indigenous women hits home for many people in Oregon. Now the state's lawmakers are considering House Bill 2625 in an effort to help solve these cases. KBOO spoke with Deborah Maytabe Shipman, an Indigenous rights leader who founded Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA, which is based in Portland. She is a member of the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma and will be a keynote speaker at Portland's Women's March.
The bill is actually on the first phase of having the state police do more investigations with the MMIW, and it also addresses the fact that there are no databases for Oregon for the missing and murdered Indigenous women or men. They're actually uncounted and misraced in almost every single level of government.
You can hear more of KABU's Emily Gresham Beamer's interview with Deborah May Tabe Shipman later on this hour on KABU News In Depth.
Oregon has a high rate of voter registration due to its motor voter registration program. Today, Governor Brown answered questions at a forum in Washington, D.C., in which people were trying to find out how to bring Oregon's success to their states. Here's how she answered one question from her home state.
Neelan Phillips, who is from Portland, Oregon. As a young working class woman of color, I often wonder whether the policies championed by our leaders have my communities in mind. Often we are only talked about around election season and as constituent groups. Our lived everyday experience is forgotten about the rest of the year. How are you centering the most marginalized communities in your agenda and ensuring that we are counted and heard year round?
Well, thank you for the question. And I just have to share our numbers around automatic voter registration. Our AVR voters are less white than the electorate as a whole. 33.9% of all likely Hispanic voters are motor voters in Oregon. 28% of all likely African American voters are motor voters. And 26% of all likely Asian voters are motor voters. So we know it's making a difference in terms of communities of color. And we're seeing it on the ground in terms of policy. And this could be a very long conversation, but for me, it's about people, it's about policy, and it's about how we spend our resources. And I just want to share a couple of the public policies we were able to pass last year. One, with really strong leadership from the legislature and my office, we were able to pass Cover All Kids, ensuring that every single child in Oregon, regardless of their immigration status, has access to health care. We were able to pass the Women's Reproductive Health Equity Act, which is landmark legislation and ensures that every woman, regardless of her income, regardless of where she lives, regardless of her immigration status, has access to the full complement of reproductive health services. So we're seeing the difference in terms of voter engagement in our policies on the ground, and that's why it's so critical that we move forward on progressive policies that ensure that every single voice is heard and that every vote is counted.
That was Governor Kate Brown speaking at a progressive forum in Washington, D.C. today about Oregon's motor voter registration process.
North Carolina election authorities on Thursday ordered a new contest, a new election for Congress in the state's 9th district. This comes after the Republican candidate, confronted by days of evidence that his campaign underwrote an illegal get-out-the-vote effort, abandoned his defense and called for a new vote. The unanimous ruling by the North Carolina State Board of Elections was a startling and, for Republicans, embarrassing turn in a case of political chicanery that convulsed North Carolina. Republican candidate Mark Harris said from the witness stand on Thursday afternoon that it's become clear that the public's confidence in the 9th District's general election has been undermined to an extent that a new election is warranted. Mr. Harris's announcement represented an abrupt collapse of the Republican effort to stop a new election in the 9th, which includes part of Charlotte and runs through much of southeastern North Carolina.
It's a country with a staggering exodus, with millions of Venezuelans leaving their country on foot. Vice President Mike Pence plans to call for the ouster of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro next week during a visit to Colombia. KABU's Ani Haynes talks to Emory Ward about a Portland-based group called Hands Off Venezuela.
Emory, you have been active with Hands Off Venezuela Portland.
That's right.
And let me know a little bit about what that group is doing.
Sure.
So you had there was a town hall with Ron Wyden on Friday.
That's right.
What happened there?
Hands Off Venezuela Portland, we had organized a rally outside the federal building in Portland the week before. So we had like 80 people there. And the basic message was, hey, no war on Venezuela, no economic war, hands off Venezuela, this is a dangerous time, pay attention. And so then a small group of us knew that Ron Wyden was having a town hall here in Multnomah County, and so we went, and our plan was to get a question asked, but we didn't manage to get the mic during the event, so we kind of just took the mic into our own hands. And yeah, I and another group member, we stood up as Ron Wyden was talking about like the importance of democracy and direct democracy, and we just started asking him in his closing statement, like, if you're all into democracy, then how do you explain what's going on in Venezuela right now? Because for those who don't know, the basics are that a man in Venezuela appointed himself the new president, and it was orchestrated in coordination with the U.S., Canada. Like, it was like a diplomatic coup. It's like, I'm the president and all these countries back me. And their basic message is, take the elected president and kick him out. Like, tell him to go to a beach somewhere, or they're going to put him in Guantanamo, or they're going to invade the country. And so we stood up and started directly confronting Ron Wyden with this, because he's basically a supporter of the coup. Like, he's with Pelosi and most of the Democrats. He had tipped his hand on that earlier in his town hall. And he just ignored us. And as soon as I could tell he was going to ignore us, I just turned to the crowd and said, like, don't leave. I'm going to talk to you for a second about Venezuela. And almost everyone listened. And Ron Wyden just walked off the stage and didn't care at all. And while I was asking the crowd, like, what do you think about, you know, Elliot Abrams and death squads in Venezuela, or a war led by Donald Trump? And yeah, the basic question I asked Wyden was, who do you stand with, the UN or Donald Trump? And he couldn't even answer this simple question.
Are you finding that there's any support in Congress or the Senate?
Maybe the most high profile. There are maybe two instances in the most high profile support. So the best support has been from Ilhan Omar, a freshman congressman. She is a Muslim, and she made waves two times in 1 week. One, she got in trouble for criticizing AIPAC, and, you know, like, forces there tried to take her out for that. And then, like, the next day or the day after, she's on the House Foreign Relations Committee, and Elliot Abrams came in. Elliot Abrams, for those who don't know, is basically, like, been put in charge of installing democracy in Venezuela, air quotes. And so she just read off, like, Mr. Abrams, why should anyone here believe anything you say? Because Abrams is a convicted criminal for lying to Congress. He pled to those charges because he was going to be charged with other much more serious felonies. So he pled to crimes that, you know, he
perjuring
was
himself in front of Congress. And that was around the Iran-Contra scandal.
Yeah.
But then he was fully pardoned.
Yes.
By Bush.
By Bush the first.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And for those who don't know about Iran-Contra, the Contras were basically like the ISIS of Nicaragua, worse than ISIS. And the U.S. was taking money from selling weapons to Iran. This was Abrams. And then funneling that money to the Contras so that they could rampage through indigenous lands, killing union members, indigenous people, cutting their heads off, just doing like the most grotesque things possible. And so Ilhan Omar then followed up saying, Mr. Abrams, you called what happened in Guatemala, for example, or El Salvador, a fabulous achievement. And then she described the El Mozote massacre, in which 800 people were massacred by these death squads that the U.S. will do in Venezuela if they can. Again, she described it, and Elliot Abrams was just got absolutely livid. And so again, then there was an attack to try to silence Ilhan Omar by the foreign policy elite in Washington. So they all kind of ganged up on her. And basically, at least on social media and on Twitter, like, they were defeated. And Ilhan Omar has survived so far. And yeah, so the other, like, a major voice in Washington would be Bernie Sanders, who he put out like a 3-tweet statement about Venezuela that was very tepid. It was somewhat good. He said we shouldn't be threatening them militarily. Probably he believes we shouldn't be doing collective punishment sanctions on Venezuela. But he prefaced all of that by saying the boilerplate awful things about Nicolas Maduro, who is the elected president of Venezuela.
All right. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you, Ani.
Today, the Portland City Council decided to extend the housing state of emergency for an additional 2 years. Here are some of the testimony from this afternoon's hearing.
I want more of a focus on those 8,000 units at the baseball stadium. There's no reason why these investors can't begin to commit those units before they do their stadium, before they do anything else. I'd like to see them commit to more of the 0 to 30% units, supportive housing, start bringing in money from Seattle, other locations, and show that you're also here to take care of the homeless, even if that stadium doesn't happen. Build those 8,000 units, start now, and show the city that you really are here to take care of the people and then possibly get your stadium put into place.
We spent months with community members, housing providers, and real estate representatives drafting a policy to allow tenants the opportunity to purchase rentals when owners choose to sell. This is a program that's worked really well in Washington, D.C. and has resulted in considerable investment in permanent affordable housing and home ownership opportunities for low-income households. However, without financial assistance for low-income renters to purchase and rehabilitate the properties, it would be a mostly empty gesture that would fail to benefit the people we are trying to assist.
Buenas tardes, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. I just wanted to do a quick follow-up to the work that has already been discussed. I am the Housing Services Program Manager with the Programa Hispano, and the Programa Hispano just is really committed and thankful that the city is taking on this work to try and mitigate some of the issues that have come about due to housing discrimination. This is extremely, extremely important and very delicate work for us, because for years now we have heard stories of participants that are coming into our office sharing their stories around housing discrimination. And what we do know is that the lack of a regulatory body to be able to enforce these fair housing rules is only, the issues that that presents only is exacerbated when talking about communities of color. So like I said, for years now we have heard these really egregious stories. In one instance particularly, a mother who really needed a place to stay had to sit through microaggressions and racist comments from a landlord just because she needed the apartment, and that was the only apartment that was quote-unquote affordable for her. But those were the circumstances that she had to deal with in order to stay housed. And this is even a more particular situation, given that we are a culturally specific agency for the Latinx community. And as you all might know, due to the current political environment that has, with issues like public charge, that has already made it very difficult for the Latinx community to trust government and law enforcement individuals, this would make them, Latinx individuals who are experiencing this housing discriminations, even more hesitant to be willing to come out and speak against it. So I think that this is why it's crucial that El Programa Hispano, a Latinx culturally specific agency that is in the community for the community, and due to all the trust that we've built, that we are, that we have positioned ourselves really, really well to be the navigators who kind of screen participants, provide trauma-informed and culturally specific case management, wraparound services for these participants, who then can seek mitigation with the attorneys that we're working with. So we just thank you for your support. We are very committed to this work because we deeply believe that it advances racial equity and housing justice in all of our communities.
The housing state of emergency was first declared by then-Mayor Charlie Hales in 2015, and it's been extended twice since then. The state of emergency allows the city and county to simplify and expedite processes aimed at growing the housing inventory and helping homeless people get off the streets. It allows officials to move quickly in opening temporary homeless shelters or trying new out-of-the-box pilot projects, like a free 2-day program to help homeless people store their belongings. It also gives the city the power to waive zoning codes and speed up approval processes needed to build affordable housing.
Multnomah County's most recent count of houseless citizens came in at 4,177, up 10% from just 2 years ago. Today, Deacon Richard Burkle of Catholic Charities of Oregon talked about this crisis. Catholic Charities has chosen Portland as one of five cities across the country for a new program to cut down the chronically houseless numbers by 20% in the next 5 years. Here's part of what Deacon Burkle told members of the media at a press conference today.
Homelessness crisis isn't just a symptom of a growing economic and social stress and inequity in our society, but it's a major public health challenge in itself. It's a crisis. Being unhoused leads to a rapid decline in health and mental health and economic stability. It's an assault on the human person. People are exposed to violence, to trauma, to harsh conditions, to cold every day. They go without sleep, they go without proper food. They're unable to focus on anything but survival. Whereas a person who is housed becomes a new person. A person who's housed matters, becomes our neighbor. A person who is housed becomes someone who's capable of growing and moving on in their lives. And that's what this project is all about. The partners that are coming together today have unique capabilities and resources to bring to the table. But we share something very important in common that allows us to do this work seamlessly. We are connected by our deep Catholic faith that recognizes the inherent God-given dignity of every human person, and further recognizes that we are all connected as a community, that we are one body, and that the suffering of our brothers and our sisters on the streets is our suffering as well.
Providence Health and the Archdiocese of Portland are teaming up with Catholic Charities for the cause.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report. I interviewed Senator Ron Wyden on the state of the government shutdown. Also, Deborah Matabe Shipman talks to KBOO's Emily Gresham Beamer on the crisis of missing Indigenous women. And KBOO's Rachel Hartley speaks to a local activist who was attacked by a hate group at his own residence. At 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy skies this evening, will become overcast overnight. Low around 30 degrees, winds light and variable. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy with rain developing later in the day, a high of 43. Winds south at 10 to 20 miles per hour, the chance of rain 90%. Rainfall we're expecting about a quarter of an inch. And today in Black history, the renowned civil rights leader Malcolm X was assassinated on this day in 1925. Also in Black history, Congresswoman Barbara Jordan was born on this day in Houston, Texas, known for her strong and commanding oratory skills. Jordan, in 1976, became the first African-American to deliver a keynote address at the Democratic National Convention. She also gave a keynote address at the 1992 Democratic Convention. Jordan was the first African-American woman elected to the United States House of Representatives from the South in 1972. Of course, our quote of the day has to be from Barbara Jordan, who said, "One thing is clear to me. We as human beings must be willing to accept people who are different from ourselves."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has released a draft environmental impact statement on the Pebble Mine project in southwest Alaska. It's a step in the permitting process. Those in opposition of the proposed copper and gold mine worry it could endanger the region's salmon. The United Tribes of Bristol Bay released a statement Wednesday expressing outrage, calling it an inadequate review of the Pebble project, claiming it ignores impacts to people and fish in the region. Pebble Limited Partnership and Northern Dynasty leaders welcomed it and said in a statement, "It's a positive development and a clear path forward for the project." The Army Corps will take comments in March through May. A former staff member of the National Congress of American Indians calls on the organization to be more transparent. After the announcement this week, its executive director, Jacqueline Peta, will be stepping down. In comments to Indians.com, former director of operations Nicole Hollingstead said employees have been pleading for help for years and have been ignored. Peta was put on leave in October following the firing of an NCAI attorney accused of sexual harassment. In a press release, Peta said after having time for thought and reflection, she's decided to resign after 18 years in the position. The statement, which included comments by NCAI President Jefferson Keel, thanked her for her service, but did not address management concerns or the allegations. Peta will continue to lead the organization during the transition. The Keystone XL pipeline has landed in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That court has opened five cases stemming from a Montana federal court order issued in November, amended in December, and again on Friday. Those orders stop pipeline construction until the U.S. State Department receives an environmental impact statement that conforms with the National Environmental Protection Act. The Rosebud Sioux Tribe in South Dakota and the Fort Belknap Indian community in Montana have also sued the State Department. They're joining as interveners on the side of environmentalists in the appeal. Victoria Wicks has more.
Natalie Landreth is an attorney for the Native American Rights Fund. She and other attorneys represent Rosebud and Fort Belknap tribes in a lawsuit against the Department of State for issuing a permit for the pipeline to cross the U.S.-Canada border. That case is set for hearing in Montana federal court on April 10th. Landreth says the Ninth Circuit will decide many issues in the appeals brought forward by the Department of State, TransCanada, environmentalists, and tribes. But Rosebud and Fort Belknap are weighing in on only one.
Initially, Secretary Kerry had denied the permit. The Trump administration comes in and they do an about-face, and they grant the permit, but they don't do any additional record finding. They have no new evidence, no new information. And that's illegal. An agency can't simply make decisions on a whim. It has to do so based on a record and a reason.
Landreth says that is the one claim the two tribes argue in their Montana suit. One of the attorneys for Fort Belknap Indian Community is Dan Belcourt. He says the pipeline is routed through the tribe's traditional homeland and in some cases through sacred ceremonial and historical sites located off-reservation. He says he and a tribal council member went to a site on the proposed pipeline route and found a medicine lodge.
It was right there in the middle of the right-of-way, and as far as we knew, there's other sites that were undocumented.
Belcourt says he's ecstatic that Montana federal judge Brian Morris has issued an injunction preventing construction of the pipeline and hopes the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals will uphold that decision. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
What's the most pressing concern on Oregonians' minds these days? If you ask Democratic U.S. Senator Ron Wyden, he'll tell you it's all about the rising cost of health care and prescription drugs. He told me that the issue of rising health care costs is a question he gets asked the most at his town hall meetings across the state.
So I get asked more than anything else about health care costs, and particularly pharmaceuticals, what you're going to do to stop the price gouging. I talk about going after the middlemen. I talk about forcing these companies to justify big rate hikes. I have introduced the RX cap to cap the out-of-pocket expenses people would have. So right up at the top of the questions I get is health care costs.
And you can hear more of my interview with Senator Ron Wyden a little bit later this hour on KBOO News In Depth.
Please be advised, this next story pertains to accounts of sexual assault. A report from the United Nations Commission on Human Rights partially blames foreign oil companies for exacerbating violence in South Sudan. That violence is waged over the control of oil production. The South Sudanese government, which holds the northern oil-rich territories of the country, produced oil in partnership with Chinese National Petroleum, Petronas, Malaysia, and the Indian Oil and Natural Gas Corporation. The commission says it's outraged about reports of thousands of civilians forced from their homes, attacks on civilians, torching of houses, killings of civilians, and the raping of women and girls. The government of South Sudan is accused of carrying out offenses using extremely violent measures to secure oil-rich territories. The international oil companies involved in the government's oil ventures could face criminal liability for their involvement in the war crimes and, crimes against humanity documented in the United Nations report.
A deadly fire raged through the Bangladeshi capital city of Dhaka Wednesday, killing at least 110 people. Fire crews had trouble reaching the fire because of narrow streets and unsafe conditions in the area. Fires in Bangladesh often carry especially deadly consequences, as the country has long struggled with fire safety enforcement. In addition, building codes are rarely enforced in urban areas. The fire was in a residential building where chemicals were stored, which made the fire even worse.
Under the Trump administration, the wait time for people applying for American citizenship has doubled. It now totals an average of 10 months, but can stretch as long as 3 years in some cases. President Trump has persuaded new hurdles to citizenship and diverted personnel and funding from the citizenship process. According to Ted Farrell, an immigration lawyer interviewed by the New York Times, monitors of the process are seeing applicants for nationalization denied, for naturalization have been denied. They are then immediately put into removal proceedings for the first time, forcing them from their permanent residences. As the administration continues to pursue aggressive citizenship limits, lawyers say they expect the wait time for naturalization to grow, as the 9 million eligible for citizenship keep waiting.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 21st, 2019. Here are the main points again. State lawmakers are considering a way to do a better job of tracking missing indigenous men and women. Governor Brown says voter registrations among people of color ranks high in our state compared to others. And Native people are concerned about the impact of salmon if a new copper and gold mine opens in Alaska. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Emily Gresham-Beamer, Annette Newell, Jenka Soderbergh, Ani Haynes, and Emery Ward. The producers are Annette Newell and Rachel Hartley, and our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.7.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Rachel Hartley. Coming up on KBOO in the morning. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, host Ani Haynes speaks with community organizer Joe Clement about class in America. At 9, it's One Land, Many Voices. At 10, on Valley View's host Dale Holliday shares her observations about rural life. At 10:15, on Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein speaks with civil rights activist Isabel Garcia about the growing violence perpetuated by U.S. security forces along the Mexican border. At 11, Pacific Underground features the full-length interview with Duncan Williams, author of American Sutra. At 11:30, it's Laura Flanders' show. Coming up next is KBOO News in Depth. And all of this KBOO programming is made possible by member support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on the button marked Donate. Hey.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
For our first News in Depth story, from the president's emergency declaration to healthcare to medicine price gouging, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden has a lot on his mind lately. And KBOO News Annette Newell talked to the senator about what he's most worried about as he answers questions at a town hall meeting across the state. Here is that in depth.
What's going on with the shutdown part two that almost happened, but now the emergency declaration?
Well, this national emergency and what the president is doing with his handling is just bizarre. I mean, first of all, this whole matter started with a fable. The president saying that the Mexicans were going to pay for the wall. There was no way the Mexicans were going to pay for the wall. But what even people close to him have said is that he just said it again and again at rallies, and he liked it. So he said, we're going to have a wall, and the Mexicans are going to pay for it. Now, with respect to this national emergency, this is just one of the most bizarre things that I can recall. In his own words, not mine, he said, I really didn't need to do this. And yet he declared a national emergency. This would be almost like somebody near our house in southeast Portland pulling a fire alarm, and after all our fire folks and our first responders show up, the person who called it in said, hey, I didn't really need to do it. This is just bizarre, and I want your listeners to know I'm going to pull out all the stops to fight this. We'll fight it in the Congress. We'll fight it in the courts. May end up being a lawyer's full employment program. But this, even by their standards, is really bizarre.
What's next in the process? I mean, I know that you said legislatively there are things you can do, and then the courts are also, there's also things to do there.
Well, I've been home, so I've not had a chance yet to consult with our lawyers in the Congress. There's a legislative route. The president obviously would at this point veto that, then we'll try to override it. But I think Republicans understand how out of step the president is with the country on this. I mean, he keeps claiming there's an emergency. We've seen the numbers on the border go down. I mean, people don't even fact check anymore because they just assume so much of this, as I said, is just a fable.
What are some of the things that people are telling you at your town halls as you're going throughout the state, hopscotching around, trying to hear from as many people as possible? What are they asking about? What are the main issues on their minds right now?
The overwhelming question is health care costs, and particularly prescription drugs. And we've been able to prod and pull and push the pharmaceutical CEOs to actually show up and testify at the Finance Committee, where I'm the ranking Democrat. And I really had to throw everything I could, finally, because they were stonewalling so and doing everything they could to keep from showing up where we could talk to them about the price gouging. I said at the last hearing, even the tobacco companies came to Congress. They lied to me about the addictiveness of nicotine, but at least they showed up. These pharmaceutical people were stonewalling and trying to keep from showing up. And so I get asked more than anything else about health care costs, and particularly pharmaceuticals, what you're going to do to stop the price gouging. I talk about going after the middlemen. I talk about forcing these companies to justify big rate hikes. I have introduced the RX cap to cap the out-of-pocket expenses people would have. So right up at the top of the questions I get is health care costs.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, on Comedy Central last night, I saw the Hasan Minhaj show, Patriot Act. He mentioned you.
What do you think?
Good things. He pointed out the crazy prices of insulin.
Insulin is a perfect example. Yeah. The price has increased. We can get it to you 6-7-fold. That's not 6 or 7-fold better. The only thing they're doing is price gouging because they can get away with it.
Mm-hmm. But he mentioned you specifically. He showed you, and he even had a clip of you talking about it, about how you're leading a fight in order to try to stop the price gouging, and pointed out the fact that there are all these people who are dying essentially because they can't afford their insulin.
It's shameful, and you hear accounts of seniors cutting their medicine in half. For a lot of families, the first thing right now, we had some testimony on this as well, that they'll have to do in their monthly budgeting is figure out how to make sure they're going to be able to pay for their kids' medicine.
And as far as Medicaid or Medicare for all, that's an idea that seems to be bandied about right now. Do you think that there's value in it, and do you think that it is really getting traction?
I think it's clear that Oregonians want us to go further than the Affordable Care Act. I mean, I was very pleased the Affordable Care Act included the provision for my bill to have loophole-free airtight protection for folks from discrimination for pre-existing conditions. The Trump people are still trying to get rid of that. But we've got to go a lot further. People are falling between the cracks. So there are a host of, you know, bills. There is Medicare for All. There is a proposal to let people go to Medicare at 50, proposals to buy into Medicaid and Medicare. What I feel really strongly about is the far right said for 7 years they were going to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. And when their dog caught the car, when they had the White House, the Senate, and the House, they didn't know how to do it. Now, I'm the ranking Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee, where we have jurisdiction over close to $2 trillion of health care spending, Medicare, Medicaid, the children's health insurance program, the tax incentives for employer coverage. I'm not going to let those of us who believe that health care is a basic human right, that there ought to be universal coverage, not access, universal coverage, I'm not going to let us fall in that trap.
Mm-hmm. It seems like we're the only country where that's the case in the industrialized world. Where,
from the standpoint of the Western industrialized world, we by and large spend more and get less. I mean, we're going to spend this year, to give your listeners a sense of how outlandish this is, this year we'll spend about $3.5 trillion on health care. There are about 320 million of us as Americans. You divide 320 million into 3.5 trillion, you could, for all practical purposes, send every family of four in America a check for $40,000 and say, here, buy your health care. We're spending enough. We're not spending it in the right places.
Where are we wasting money in the budget?
Well, certainly I've ticked off, you know, health care costs. There ought to be a way to centralize the billing and administrative cost aspect of this. There's such a blizzard of forms and differences in various private insurers. That needs to be changed. And there are a whole host of potential opportunities. I was able to get a breakthrough in Medicare. I've been working on it for years because Medicare has changed very dramatically since the days when I was co-director of the Oregon Gray Panthers and would come and talk at your station. Medicare used to be an acute care program, like if you broke your ankle or you had a horrible case of the flu. Medicare still covers those services. That's not where the money goes. Medicare today is a chronic illness program. It's cancer, diabetes, heart disease, strokes, chronic pulmonary disease. It's a chronic illness program to the point where pretty soon 80% of the Medicare spending is going to go where seniors have two or more of those conditions. Anyway, I was able to get the Chronic Care Act passed in the last Congress. One of the key parts is independence at home, so that people could get more of their care where they're comfortable and where it is not as expensive as the alternative institutional.
Okay, thank you so very much. Okay. I appreciate your time.
That was KBOO's Annette Newell speaking with Senator Ron Wyden. Next Thursday, find out what he has to say about his fellow Democrats running for president. KBOO's Emily Gresham Beamer spoke to the keynote speaker for the upcoming Women's March, where she discusses the impact of missing Indigenous women across the nation.
I'm Emily Gresham Beamer with KBOO News. Yesterday, I spoke with Deborah Matabe Shipman, an Indigenous rights leader and member of the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma. Shipman founded Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA and will be a keynote speaker at Portland's Women's March. I was also joined by Kelly Caldwell of Greater Portland Now, an intersectional feminist organization and chapter of the National Organization for Women. Together, they organized carpools to Salem, bringing supporters of today's hearing on House Bill 2625. Welcome to KABU, Deborah and Kelly. I'd like to ask you both this question, but I'll start with you, Deborah. Could you tell KABU listeners a little bit about yourself and your support for House Bill 2625? And where should people go to support or find out more about Greater Portland Now and Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA?
My name's Deborah Maytobe Shipman. I'm from the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma, and I'm the leader and founder of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA, which is based here in Portland. The bill is actually on the first phase of having the state police do more investigations with the MMIW, and it also addresses the fact that there are no databases for Oregon for the missing and murdered Indigenous women or men. They're actually uncounted and misraced in almost every single level of government.
And you, Kelly, could you tell KABU listeners a little bit about yourself and your support for this bill?
Hi, I'm Kelly. I'm a board member with Greater Portland Now. I've been on the board just a few months. The efforts of the murdered and missing Indigenous women movement is right up our alley. This bill was endorsed by Representative Tana Sanchez, and so the first hearing for that is this Thursday at 1 o'clock. And there are major issues with data tracking that are a major part of this bill. But what I'm mostly excited by is the new attention on making sure that we're doing right by these women and by this community. We know that the heart of this bill is about prioritizing the concerns of the families affected and addressing more resources and support to solving the issues of missing and murdered Indigenous women.
Deborah, does the missing and murdered Indigenous women movement have any priority issues in Oregon right now?
We want every family to be addressed. Right now, all the families, MMIW families, they absolutely have been abandoned by law enforcement. Just a note, Oregon reservations, those reservations are not that tribe's land. It's actually federal government's land, and they're in charge of anything over a misdemeanor is a federal crime. And they absolutely rarely even investigate. They take statements. They actually record the crime, but there's no investigation. And every MMIW family I know in Oregon has the same story. They have the same story. They don't know what happened. A lot of them don't know where their mother is. A friend of mine, Carolyn DeFord, her mom's been missing for 18 years from Eastern Oregon, from La Grande area. She has to initiate every conversation with the FBI or the BIA. They do not give updates to these families.
Deborah, are there any programs MMIW USA is currently implementing that you're excited about and would be willing to share?
My organization, we actually are national, but we are completing one of our goals right now to start programs that are preventative. Staying Sacred is our program for young women and girls, and it actually is going really, really well, and the girls are very involved. And please know that we have professionals at every meeting that are talking about, like, this Saturday at Suicide. Native American adolescents have the highest suicide rates in the United States. And that's probably another thing that you're going to be hearing about more as these figures come out on our MMIW. Also, these other issues of generational trauma are affecting our people so much.
How does House Bill 2625 align with Greater Portland Now's mission as an organization?
The work on this particular bill and supporting this MMIW initiative is really right on point with Greater Portland Now's strategic goals. We are specifically reaching out to organizations led by women of color and supporting their work with regard to economic justice, reproductive rights, eliminating racism, and ending violence against women. So this feels like exactly what we should be doing right now, and we hope to continue to build support for it, build capacity for it, and to, in general, build our women's movement to end violence and racism.
What impact can data collected during investigations of the deaths of Indigenous men and women have on the Indigenous community?
So how data is taken at crime scenes and in the mortuary and in hospitals. These are all really important questions when it comes to resources and attention and focus.
Yeah, and this cause of death thing is so messed up. Even with wounds that are to the head, to the chest, they're still counted as natural deaths in a lot of these coroner reports. Or they'll say that they succumb to the elements, that they
died
from exposure and stuff. That's the number one thing that they say. But that's not what happened. That's not what happened to these people. That's a huge issue with this is the cause of death. I've seen so many. We've got a family. I'm not going to say her name. She was found in the Columbia, and she had wounds that killed her, but they said it was a drowning. That's a huge issue in these Native Americans' death that need to be addressed. That's just hurtful. I feel that it's cruel. It's cruel to the family. They're re-victimized by these things.
It's one thing I've seen that is so ugly is when an Indigenous woman goes missing and someone just says, oh, did she run away? Is she off doing something that she shouldn't do? Well, that shouldn't be necessarily our first question when we know that we have an epidemic of violence against women and especially Native women. The first question could be, is this woman safe? What do we need to do to help this woman be safe wherever she is?
One other thing I just want to say something about is the jurisdictional nightmare that these families fall into. We've had two missing Native women in Portland in the last 2 weeks. I'm happy to say we recovered those women alive and safe. But we were able to be successful because of volunteers, because of going out and blanketing the community with their pictures. But the one thing that we had that the reservation population doesn't is the jurisdictional nightmare that happens on Warm Springs, on Klamath. We were lucky we dealt with Portland Police. And as of last year, Portland Police are aware of the MMIW situation, and we had terrific luck in working with them in the last 2 weeks. They don't have that luxury on the federal reservations. They don't have that luxury in rural Oregon. And we need to make sure that we have a protocol set. If somebody goes missing, this is what happens.
Kelly, Greater Portland Now is holding a volunteer orientation this Sunday at 2. Could you share some of the major upcoming events volunteers could be involved in and what volunteers can expect from the orientation?
We will be covering a lot of the logistics, getting people signed up to help with setup and cleanup and all the variety of tasks. There's some other important components of that gathering, and that is to help volunteers, men and women, show up and understand a little bit more about our context and our history and where we're going to go from here. Someone isn't just helping to collect the trash afterwards, but understanding that this is part of a larger movement and how they can be involved. I do want to mention the short-term goals. So obviously, we're going to be at the hearing on Thursday. We're inviting people to support this bill. Obviously, volunteering for the Women's March. Deborah is going to be one of the keynote speakers at the march. And so there'll be plenty of opportunities to learn more by attending the volunteer orientation this Sunday at 2, by coming to the Women's March on Sunday, March 3rd, where they can hear more from Deborah as well as from other folks about what's happening with this bill and how people can get involved and take action to support women, to support the MMIW movement, and to make positive change.
And where should people go to support or find out more about Greater Portland Now and Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA?
People can check out our Greater Portland Now Facebook page or come to an upcoming meeting or activity.
Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA is our Facebook page. And we also have a webpage, MMIWUSA.org.
Thank you so much for speaking with us. That was Deborah Madeby Shipman of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA and Kelly Caldwell of Greater Portland Now speaking with us about House Bill 2625. It will fund and support investigations involving the deaths of missing and murdered Indigenous people in Oregon in partnership with Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA. Thanks for tuning in. For KBOO News, I'm Emily Gresham.